Hello, I'm Kaya Willoughby, and joining me is Claire White.
Hello.
And this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. We're here to discuss new nerd creations, how they were made, exploring roots of characters, maybe some stories, definitely some stories. Today we are talking about Stranger Things, a new Netflix show that dropped on July 15th, and it is filled to the brim with homages to 80s adventure, sci-fi, and horror.
Pretty exciting.
It's pretty exciting. It's a big deal right now. There's a lot of people talking about it, and I think we were like maybe a little early getting on this. I feel a little special, like we almost knew about it before everyone else knew.
Almost is the key word.
Almost, but not quite. Claire will be telling us about the production of the show and the Duffer Brothers, the creators, and I will be telling us about the kind of history behind some of the tropes and a lot of the archetypes and nostalgia that they use in the show, because it's full of nostalgia.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah. So I guess I will jump on it. Stranger Things, a brief history. The first thing I noted while doing research for the show and trying to delve into some of the homages that it does and some of the tropes is that every review of Stranger Things included the adjective Spielbergian.
Yeah. And I can see why.
Yeah. And maybe I might be just paraphrasing a little bit. Maybe not every review, but the vast majority. And I kept seeing Spielbergian. And I get it, like, it's of and or pertaining to Steven Spielberg, but I didn't quite know what that meant.
So what does it mean, Kyle? Did you work it out?
I worked it out for me, what I think it means, because Spielberg's got such a huge library of movies. He's directed 26 movies, and to me, Spielbergian always meant kind of like a World War II movie and sentimentality, and that is not...
That's not what I think of Spielberg as.
Yeah, so it's a different word to different people. I secretly think that one person in a review used it and knew what they were talking about. Everyone else saw it and was like, oh, that's good, yeah. And just copied it.
They're all on the same Twitter feed, and they were like, great idea.
So I watched a ton of Spielberg interviews and about a lot of his movies, and this is what I think Spielbergian means as pertaining to Stranger Things.
Okay.
So, first thing, good child actors. Spielberg is notorious for, maybe notorious is a strong word, but in his movies with children, he's typically gotten a lot of great child actors. He used Christian Bale as a child.
Drew Barrymore
as a child. Yeah. So he can really find those talented child actors, I think. And puts them in the right place. And I don't know that that's necessarily what other people think when they hear Spielbergian, but for me, that's one thing I noted, especially in comparison to Stranger Things, because Stranger Things, I think, has great child actors.
I think he does things very well from a child's perspective. Well, that's what I think.
Yeah, that's my next point, is one of the things he also does really well, whether it's a E.T. sci-fi movie or a movie about British boy growing up in China during World War II, is seeing kind of an adult world and adult themes through the eyes of children. And you see that in Jurassic Park, even, I would say, with the
Definitely,
kids in Jurassic Park.
Yeah, with those raptors.
Yeah, with the raptors and these kids experiencing things that, you know, a normal kid wouldn't experience. A normal adult wouldn't experience too, but I feel like a normal kid is almost... It's heightened, yeah. So you see that in Jurassic Park, you see it in E.T., you see it in War of the Worlds, even, which he also directed.
Dakota Fanning.
Yeah. You see it in AI, which he didn't direct the whole thing, but he worked with Stanley Kubrick and then finished the movie after Stanley Kubrick had died. And you see it in Empire of the Sun. Another point I think that was coming from, or that pertains to Spielbergian, is capturing that nostalgic sense of childhood, wonder, and hope. And even though his movies can be kind of dark and sad, there's still, especially in movies with kids, there's still this like sense of wonder and hope and optimism that still permeates them even when things get bad, which is, I think, a big trait for him. Also, the dysfunctioning family unit is a big part of a lot of his movies with kids. Like, you see that in E.T.
Yeah, and through the kid's eyes. So like, even though the kid might not be aware, you see what's wrong through how they see it.
Yeah, yeah. The Close Encounters of the Third Kind is another movie that kind of deals with that family dysfunction with Richard Dreyfuss's character. Also, kids growing up and losing some of that kind of childhood innocence and kind of longing for that old nostalgia is a big thing that you'd see in his movies.
Hook.
Yeah, the adult kind of longing for that old childhood adventure and finding that again in himself. That's another thing he does, is adults kind of finding that inner child. And he describes himself as a fully grown child.
Yeah, in his movies show that.
Yeah, yeah. So the next thing I really want to talk about is Kids on Bikes.
Yeah, this is what I'm excited for.
The Kids on Bikes adventure and where that kind of came from, because you see it a lot in 80s movies, and I feel like you don't quite see it anymore today.
Kids don't ride bikes anymore.
Kids don't ride bikes anymore, I guess. Well, even, I mean, I was barely born in the 80s, and even movies that I watched growing up, it didn't seem like there were kids adventuring by themselves on bikes.
It seemed like it was a thing of nostalgia when I was a kid, because it wasn't safe anymore to do that.
Yeah, yeah. So the Kids on Bike sci-fi adventure is definitely a staple of the early 80s movies. You have movies like The Goonies.
Yeah, I love The Goonies.
Came out in 1985. You have movies like E.T. came out in 1982. There's some other movies that I put in the Kids on Bikes category, but they're not necessarily riding bikes around. But movies like War Games came out in 1983, and I would even kind of say Weird Science, which came out in 1985, and also one of my favorite movies, The Last Starfighter, I'd put in this, like, teenage adventure sort of thing. And they're not necessarily all on bikes, but it's, like, the same sort of age group. So the Kids on Bikes story, it's like, why was that a thing? And you look at the kind of archetypes of these movies, and you see that it's this, you're kind of coming of age, you're getting freedom with this bike, being able to kind of go around the neighborhood, but you can't go too far. You can't go so far that it's going to be dangerous. They're silent. You can get with your friends. You can kind of circumvent adults. And it's like the young kid getting his first little taste of freedom and the dangers that kind of come with that.
That makes total sense. I was thinking bike is freedom.
Yeah.
You don't need to be taken by your parents to wherever you're going.
To wherever you're going. And all of a sudden you have your first chance to have your own adventure with your buddy who lives down the street.
So cool.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. And you see it a lot in those 80s movies, like I said, not a lot after and not a lot before. So I was trying to find out when were like some of the early kind of kids on bikes having fantasy sci-fi adventures. 60s literature.
What books?
60s literature, I think, can be traced back to authors like Madeline L'Engle and Ray Bradbury. Madeline L'Engle wrote
Wrinkle
in Time. Ray Bradbury wrote a whole host of books. And Ray Bradbury, who I want to start with as far as these two authors go, wrote a really famous book that a lot of people have to read in school called Fahrenheit 451. But he wrote a whole slew of other sci-fi fantasy books, a lot of them having to do with kind of kids adventuring. The one I want to mention most, and there's a book that I loved as a kid, is Something Wicked This Way Comes. It came out in 1962, and it follows two 13-year-old friends, and they kind of have a weird carnival comes to their small Midwestern town, and they go and they have adventures in there. It's kind of a nightmarish experience. It's almost a horror book. But the kids are able to kind of save the day and save the adults around them through...
Do they ride bikes?
Being a kid, they ride bikes. Yeah, yeah.
I haven't read that book.
It's good. It's really good. It's really cool. It's very like good versus evil, and it's one of those things that you see in that book. When I was looking up Spielbergian, it's like these hopeful kids in this dark place, but are able to overcome this darkness. In the same way that Spielberg keeps a lot of that hopeful kid optimism in his books, even when things get dark and scary. Madeline L'Engle, which is another book that author that I read a lot of, Wrinkle in Time.
That was one of the first like novels that I ever read.
Yeah, I remember my mom giving it to me when I was probably 10 years old.
My mom gave it to me, too.
Being like, you should totally read this book, and I loved it. And that came out in 1963, so that's a year after Something Wicked This Way Comes. And it's a story about a 13-year-old girl who, with a classmate and her younger brother, go on this adventure to get their father back after he had gone missing while working on a secret government project.
That sounds so 80s.
It sounds so 80s, but it's the 60s, written in 1963.
She knew.
So did Ray Bradbury. And actually, Ray Bradbury's book, Something Wicked This Way Comes, had a film adaptation in 1983.
60s nostalgia in the 80s.
Kids on bikes. So both of these stories seem to have really helped create the kids on bikes archetype, I think, that you saw in those 80s movies. They're also very nostalgic books, and I was watching a lot of Spielberg interviews trying to find a time where he mentions either of those books or either of those authors or anything, and he never does.
It's just the idea.
It's just the idea, or it's almost like this archetype that existed, that he was the first, like, it was kind of in the ether, and he was the first one to tap it on film.
Or to tap it very successfully on film.
Yeah, yeah. And they have a lot of the same tropes that you see in these 80s adventure horror films with kids. And a lot of the same tropes, once again, you see in Stranger Things on Netflix. So it's very cool, and they're all building off each other. And not being able to find a Spielberg mentioning either of these books was really funny to me. Because I don't believe that he...
wasn't influenced by them?
I don't think that he read them and keeps it like his dirty secret. I think it's just something that maybe was kind of permeating the subconscious or something that he was able to express really well in movies.
Right, or that those books infected culture to such a degree that he was affected
that
by it.
That he felt that. Yeah. And lastly, you can't talk about this show and its influences without mentioning Stephen King. Because he is clearly a huge influence on this show, specifically his book Carrie, which was published in 1974. It was actually Stephen King's first published book.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty cool. It's real short. It concerns a 16-year-old girl who is growing up in a really religious household with her mother, who's a Christian fundamentalist, and it's her kind of coming of age and then learning that she has telekinetic powers. And her mother is very isolating and very controlling. And you see a lot of parallels between Carrie from that book and Elle from Stranger Things.
That makes so much sense.
And another huge influence on at least monster creation, the monster in Stranger Things, you got to look at H.R. Giger. If you don't know who he is, everyone go out and Google H.R. Giger. He was an artist who had an enormous influence on a lot of the horror and sci-fi stuff of the 80s. And even now, like, he had a big influence on Aliens, Genova from Final Fantasy VII, the video game is clearly pulled from his stuff. And just a really interesting artist. If you want to see some freaky artwork.
Yeah, we'll link to him on the Facebook page.
Yes, we will. So there's a ton of stuff I could talk about with this, but we only have so much time. Claire, I would love to hear about your production side.
All right. Well, like you mentioned, it's written and directed by the Duffer Brothers. Their names are Matt and Ross. I just want to mention they're born in 1984. So,
which is shocking.
Yeah, but they came of age in the 90s. And I came of age in the 90s, too. And I do think these movies like E.T. and The Goonies and Spielbergian movies, I associate that with childhood.
Same with me. I came of age in the 90s. And, yeah, these older movies were kind of the kid fun kid movies.
Yeah, that your parents loved, too, that they made you watch.
Yeah.
Well, they didn't. I guess they made me and then I loved it. So, I mean, these guys are obviously super talented. They got a production deal with Warner Brothers straight out of college.
Oh, wow.
What you would have known them from before is they wrote and directed the thriller Hidden, which came out in 2015.
Oh, I never heard of it.
Yeah, it's one of those, like, you're in a bunker, post-apocalyptic coming for you. And they contributed to the Wayward Pine scripts, which is the TV show on Fox. But that's pretty much what they've been known for before this.
Yeah.
And so what they did that I think is super cool is that between them and their producer, Sean Levy, and he's best known for directing Night at the Museum, they were the only ones who directed any episodes in this series because they wanted a unified voice and vision throughout the entire show. And this, which they didn't want to risk ruining the aesthetic.
Yeah.
When developing the show, they were talking about if they could watch any show, what would they want to watch? And like they said before, like we were talking about before, that childhood nostalgia, they wanted to watch a show that kind of went back to that childhood nostalgia and the classic films that they loved growing up. And they wanted a show that kids could watch. Like, it's pretty PG-13.
Yeah, it's no Game of Thrones. It's not gratuitous.
No, there's no gratuitous sex. It's not super gory.
Yeah.
There's some cursing. There's a lot of cursing.
There's cursing. There is violence, but there's no one's like holding their intestines.
No one's getting tortured. Yeah. Well, kind of. Yeah. If you watch the show, you'll understand. But it's not, you can't watch this happen to someone type thing that I feel like has become kind of popular nowadays.
Yeah.
And of course, this movie is made by movie nerds. And the Duffer brothers say they are movie nerds in the biggest way. And their biggest inspirations were, of course, Steven Spielberg, Stephen King, which isn't a movie, but Stephen King, John Carpenter, Wes Craven, a lot of these.
Yeah.
I want to say old horror directors. Yeah. There's the beginning of the horror genre.
Yeah. Jonathan, one of the characters in the show who's in high school, has a poster of Evil Dead on his wall.
Yeah. They also wanted the 80s setting. But they didn't want to be commenting on the time. They wanted to just recreate it. They didn't want it to be retro or ironic. Just here we are in this time.
It tells a cool story being in the 80s. No cell phones. Kids just had to wander around for fun. No video games. It seems just more...
Atari is mentioned, but
Atari
very briefly.
Atari is mentioned, yeah.
And speaking of the 80s, they also had this idea of a paranormal missing child story, and they thought it would fit in well with all these mysterious government experiments that were happening at the end of the Cold War.
Mm.
And I want to talk about how they kind of brought this to TV, because I feel like these are all movie tropes, and they didn't make a movie. They made a TV show. So the Duffers say that they think right now movies are all kind of following the same narratives, and TV is the medium where these narratives are being broken. I mean, you think of Game of Thrones and Breaking Bad,
Mad Men. The Russo brothers mentioned the same thing in their movies, saying that movies are now, you need to direct movies like TV.
Well, yeah, and Sean Levy, the producer, he was saying that movies are going towards domains of just being superheroes and fairy tales. So all the new creators are being drawn to TV.
Yeah.
Also, they said, and I thought this was super interesting, that Winona Ryder is one of the lead characters in this, and she's the big name in it. But they don't think Winona Ryder would have done this show 4 years ago. They think after Matthew McConaughey in True Detective, he just opened up this world where
he
now
made it more
it's
more legitimate.
Yeah, now it's acceptable that big film stars are doing TV projects.
I thought it was funny that they cast her and that she's such a big 80s name.
Right.
And she was a girl in the 80s in movies like Heathers. And
I mean, I read a ton of interviews and they always say that it wasn't intentional. It was like this cool icing on top. But they wanted her because they think she's a good actress. However, there is that also nostalgic feel for Winona Ryder.
Yeah.
And they love Netflix because it allows people to watch an 8-hour movie. And that's actually how they approach the show.
I also love Netflix for the same reason.
Oh, see, it intimidates me for the same reason. I'm like, oh no, this is such a commitment.
Yeah, it is. It's like you have a girlfriend all of a sudden, or boyfriend.
Yeah, for 8 hours.
Very intensive.
Yeah. You have to really commit to it. Netflix also sounds like it's an ideal culture to work in for this because they're really about freedom and responsibility for the creators. They say that their job is helping support them fulfill their vision. And it's not about Netflix's vision.
Very
it's about
cool.
the creator's vision. Yeah, doesn't that sound great?
Very much against the normal studio sort of idea.
And they say the only time, this is Netflix saying this, so who knows? But the only time that they'll kind of come in and fix things is if they feel the show has gone away from what the creators originally pitched. And they'll come in and say, didn't you originally say that you were going to do this?
So just kind of like keeping people a little bit on task, not necessarily being a forceful hand.
Yeah. And this is something I'm really excited to talk about. I want to talk about Netflix. And we haven't talked about Netflix, actually, on this podcast.
Surprisingly, we really haven't.
Yeah, and we've only done one other Netflix show. But I feel like there's such a force in the entertainment industry. They're changing the TV and the film industry right now.
And they're putting out a lot of nerdy stuff.
So they're just ripe for us.
Yeah, yeah.
So I want to talk about Netflix, their original TV series. They're also getting into documentaries and films and comedy, stand-up specials, but this is a TV series, so we're going to talk about Netflix original TV series. It began in 2011 with a $100 million bet on House of Cards.
$100 million bet on House of Cards?
Yeah, it's what cost them to make that.
Oh, wow.
And they have this straight-to-series strategy, which basically means that instead of producing a pilot, which a lot of the network TV shows do, and then the network will watch the pilot, the network execs will watch the pilot
and decide
if it's worth investing money in. Netflix just makes the whole series. They commit to it. And they said that actually happened because at the time, Cindy Holland was in charge of the department, but it was a department of one.
Oh.
And they wanted to prove that they were committed to being serious about the business.
Yeah.
Also, they were outsiders and they wanted to try different things that might work for them that might not work for the networks.
I feel like the networks, and maybe it's just looking back on it now with all this great streaming services, but the networks seem a little old.
They are. I mean, as far as TV is concerned, network TV is old.
It's
changing so much.
And it has a formula that maybe isn't the best formula anymore.
I mean, sometimes it works.
It does. Network TV is still good. There's still great network shows.
Right. And shows that I don't think are great still do well.
Still do well. No, that's true.
Two and a Half Men was on for a long time.
Yeah.
Also, they were saying that even if they don't think the show that they produced is very good, they're still going to put it up because some of their subscribers will watch it, and some of them will like it. They'll always have an audience that will like it.
That's very positive thinking on Netflix.
I think it's true, though. They have so many subscribers.
This is true. This is true.
Another fun fact.
Very fun.
You would think they're producing all these new TV shows, right? It seems like every month there's a new
Netflix
something thing. Coming out on Netflix. Do you know that it uses the majority of its revenue to pay studios for licensing?
That's shocking, actually, to me.
It's because it's almost not what you go to Netflix for anymore.
No.
Yeah, and they pay more. They put more money towards that than Hulu or Amazon, which are its quote-unquote competitors. I mean, they are its competitors.
Yeah.
Well, in January of 2016, there was a letter to the shareholders that said that they planned on launching over 600 hours of original programming this year. They had current plans for new seasons of 30 or so original series, eight original films, a dozen documentaries, and 9 stand-up comedy specials.
Wow.
Yeah. And the idea is that with more original programming, that allows them to have greater creative and business control and ensure that they can let everyone have access to their content.
And maybe if their content becomes big enough, they don't have to keep paying so much money for licensing people's shows.
Ultimately, Netflix's goal is that you buy Netflix, you subscribe to it for their original programming that they own.
I think we're almost there. Like, it's getting close to being there.
I kind of feel like I am there. I pretty much only watch Netflix original shows on Netflix. So
yeah.
Netflix, if you're listening, it's working.
Yeah. I'll have like a comfort show. Like if I don't know what to do but want to watch something, I'll put on Parks and Rec. But you're right. Otherwise, it's the Netflix original stuff. Daredevil, Jessica Jones, this show now, Stranger Things.
Yeah, Master of None.
Master of None.
I really liked.
Oh, yeah, that was a great show.
Also, they're expanding into the international market. They are now available for streaming in up to 190 countries.
Yeah, I had a friend in England, and I remember not too long ago, I remember being shocked that she couldn't get Netflix over there.
Well, she can now.
What?
But it's also an interesting thing with the rights because they sold the rights to international broadcasting companies to some of their earlier TV shows like House of Cards.
Oh, really?
So now they're trying to get those back. But originally they had sold those rights.
Yeah. Oh, that's rough.
Yeah. But I mean, it got it out there. I guess early on you have to do that.
Yeah.
And traffic continues to rise in comparison to their competition. And real fast, I want to mention how the show is doing. This is about 3 weeks after it aired. We're recording this. So according to Parrot Analytics, which is a data science company that measures the demand for TV content, Stranger Things was the most popular digital original series from July 17th to the 23rd.
It's pretty big.
Yeah, and it was the second most popular series overall, right behind.
That's really big.
Who is it behind?
Game of Thrones?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's really big.
Really big.
Because, like, to be the top of digital original content, it's like big fish in a small pond. To be second in general,
to Game of Thrones.
It's a big fish in a big pond.
Yeah. And it's a brand new show. Like, yeah. Brand new. No book series behind it.
No, yeah. All.
No built-in fan base.
Yeah.
Duffer Brothers are new.
Very cool.
And the second season hasn't been released yet. And Netflix is saying, like, we don't want to jump the shark. Though by the time this episode airs, it might have been released. I'm sure they're going to make a second season.
Released or renewed, you mean?
Renewed.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kyle.
No problem.
But they do have plans for a sequel, which makes me feel so much more comfortable. Because a lot of times the first season can be really good, and then the creators never really thought about a second season. They just worked really hard on the first one.
Yeah.
And it's kind of forced.
Well, the cool thing about this show was that it ended and most of your questions were answered, and you're cool. If it is just one season, I'm still okay with it. But I would like to see more because there was some unanswered stuff.
Right. And they want the sequel to be a direct continuation of what this is.
Awesome. So I think it's time to go into opinions. And I feel like it's clear in the way both of us talked about this. Claire, you liked it, right?
I sure did, Kyle. And you liked it?
Of course I liked it. It was so cool.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, what were some of the things you liked about it, Claire?
Well, I was really nervous to watch this. We kind of agreed that we were going to do it for the podcast, and I would never have watched it otherwise. But I don't like scary movies. I talked about this in the Witch podcast that we do. Did. But I liked this. And it wasn't horror scary. It was just suspenseful.
It wasn't. Yeah.
And I thought it was so good. And oh my gosh, that nostalgia. It just hits you.
Oh, it hits you. They press those buttons at exactly the right time.
They really did. It was very well made. Just they knew how to hit the right beats at the right time.
Without it being redundant or a little or too self-referential or anything.
Yeah, and it made me nostalgic for my childhood, whether it was because of the movie itself or the content itself or just watching kids be kids. I'm like, oh, playing Dungeons and Dragons, like downstairs with your friends. Well, I wasn't playing Dungeons and Dragons, but I was certainly
downstairs with friends
singing karaoke to Sailor Moon at some point.
Yeah, and it's funny, like the Spielbergian thing about that kind of touching on childhood nostalgia. I never felt that with Steven Spielberg movies because I was a child.
Yeah, so you related to it.
So this was like, it almost made me get Spielberg more.
Yeah, I have this hankering now to watch E.T.
Yeah,
I haven't
me too.
Seen it since I was young.
Me too.
I'm sure it's just as good. The thing is, I'm so sure it's going to be great when I go back and watch it.
One of the things I really wanted to talk about is the casting in the show. It was phenomenal.
It was really good. Those kids.
The child actors, which I think oftentimes will make or break a movie, show, whatever, because they can be so bad.
They were so good. And they weren't models.
No, that's what I love. They weren't Abercrombie models. These weren't the kids from Jurassic World who like looked like they just stepped off a Hollister ad or whatever. These were awkward-looking middle schoolers and high schoolers.
Yeah.
Their bodies weren't fully developed. They were kind of frumpy.
They played Dungeons and Dragons.
They played Dungeons and Dragons. They looked like nerds, and they looked just so genuine.
Yeah, and I love the friendships. I don't want to actually spoil this because it's a bit later on, but there's some conversations that are just so childhood friendship.
Yeah.
And
you're right.
I remember having those conversations.
Yeah.
Also in the same vein, I want to talk about Nancy and Barb, and they're in high school and they're best friends, and just how well that friendship is done. And it's very peripheral. It's not, I mean, it is a big part of the series, but just how they interact.
Still seemed familiar. Right?
And the roles that they take with each other, I feel like I have been Nancy at some point who's dating like this guy and she's really excited about it. And Barb, who's kind of her sidekick. And I've been Barb.
Yeah.
I've been both of them. And I get both of them. And it just, I feel like that's rarely seen. You don't get to see that kind of like, oh, we're still really close, but we're really dealing with something here. And this is how we individually are dealing with it within our friendship.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Yeah. No, the high school relationships that they depicted in this show, I thought were pretty good, pretty on point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they felt very familiar.
Yeah.
To what, you know, I went through. And I guess, you know, with you, what you went through. A big part of this show, I think, that I really want to touch upon is that it's almost like an 8-hour long movie. We mentioned that. It's a show. It kind of just runs start to finish. It doesn't have like any filler episodes. They all follow the same narrative. And it's kind of three movies all in one. It's three movies in an 8-episode show.
You explained this to me earlier, and it is fascinating. I don't watch a lot of horror movies. I had no idea about this.
So there's three different groups of people in the show that it really follows, and they're all separate. There's the group of kids looking to find their friend who goes missing. There's the teenagers who are also looking for a friend who goes missing. And there's the adults, once again, looking for that first missing kid. And the way each of these stories functions almost follows a different kind of movie. The kids and their story follow kind of that fun adventure, E.T. almost.
Spielbergian movie.
Story. The teenagers follow almost a classic horror flick. Beats and pauses and everything that happens with them is almost like scene for scene or event to event, something you would see in like an old teen horror movie. And then the adults, I don't really have a movie for them. But the adults follow their own storyline too, which is separate and I think kind of is more about working through grief. So we're running out of time. I just wanted to lastly mention something that I found really cool as somewhat of a music nerd. Is the soundtrack for this show was really cool. Like, the soundtrack in general, I loved all the synthy tones and the pop music they pulled from it. But specifically, the opening theme, which kind of opens with this arpeggiated major 7 chord, is a very, very similar opening, and I'm pretty sure it's the same chord as to the Genova theme from Final Fantasy VII. Video game.
I want everyone to know he has not stopped talking about
it's
this.
It's so cool.
All I've heard about all night.
It's really, I don't know. But it makes sense because the monster is kind of Geiger inspired and Genova's kind of Geiger inspired.
This is for all five people that are going to get this reference. Understand. If you're one of them, you're welcome.
Yes, yes. So Stranger Things, you're welcome, guys, for me cluing you into that Final Fantasy thing. And
even if you're not a horror fan, you should check it out.
Yeah, very, very cool little program. And I can't wait for season 2. So thank you all so much for listening. Once again, I'm Kyle Willoughby.
And I'm Claire White.
And we are Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, A Nerd Manual. Feel free to contact us on our website at dsrapodcast.com. We would love it if you could rate and review us on iTunes, because who doesn't love to be rated and reviewed? Hopefully highly. You can find the show on Twitter at DSRA Podcast. I can be found on Twitter at Klex303. That's KLEX303.
I can be found at Along with Claire. That's CLAIRE.
And you can find our producer James at James Fowey Jr. on Twitter. That's James Fowey, FOUHEYJR. You can learn more about Stranger Things on our Facebook page, where Claire and I will be posting some of our show notes. And I'm going to post some stuff about H.R. Geiger, who's the artist I mentioned earlier that influenced a lot of the horror genre in the 80s and even today. And also, we'd love to hear what you thought of the show, of Stranger Things, and of the materials we're going to be putting on our Facebook page.
Or if you disagree with what we thought.
Yeah, because there were people who didn't like it. I read a couple negative reviews, although they were mostly positive, but you might not like it. Our producer, who wishes he could be cast as Gaston, like the worst character in Disney, is James Fowey. Our logo was done by Patty Hyland, and she would make a mean Mulan, I think, for the live-action Mulan that I'm sure will come out. And our theme was composed by Pete Rowan, who would also be a wonderful Mushu. Once again, this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, A Nerd Manual. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.